Hello, everybody, and welcome to another Awesome Curious live stream. Today, I am joined by my wonderful co-host, Micah Hoffman, and we are here, and we are here to interview Alex Slotnick. Alex is, in fact, a pretty active member of the Awesome community. He has given a lot of presentations. He has shared very interesting things with the community, and we are here today with him to pick his brain a little bit and to learn more about his background. All of that in a few seconds. Back. Hello, everybody, again. And we have today together Michael as well. How are you, Michael?
Good. Yourselves?
Very good. Micah, and you?
I'm doing well as well, adjusting to time zones since the recent DEF CON conference. So all's good over here.
Excellent. And we are joined by Alex Slotnick, whose introduction I'm going to go into soon. But first, we are the Awesome Curious Project. We are doing regular live streams with interviews about very interesting people like Alex today. We have a Twitter page, Awesome Curious, a Discord. We have our LinkedIn community and all of you guys. You can see all of the details down in the banner below. And of course, we have the website through which you can see all of the previous live streams and the blog posts. Now, Alex, how are you doing? Welcome.
I'm doing fantastic. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you with us. A few words about who Alex is. So he has a background in desktop support, and he used to also work in SOC and IR. But he figured out he loves OSINT a little too much, and today he's currently employed as a threat intelligence analyst in corporate America. But on the side, he's also volunteering at the National Child Protection Task Force as a case tracking and statistics lead. Is that right?
That's correct. That's me.
Perfect. So from a background of desktop support and SOC, how did you end up in OSINT and what made you stick with it?
Well, you know, so I think going back a little bit, I'm just a puzzle person. I love puzzles. I've loved games all my life. So I got into, you know, SOC and IR, and I did desktop support, which are their own kinds of puzzles. But I had a particular need come up. I had an investigation actually that I did as a security. You know, you get these sometimes as a security person, you get little things dropped to you that maybe aren't necessarily security, but they're just kind of, you're maybe the best person for the job. You're the only team with the technical know-how. So we had a need to kind of figure out, okay, like we have a social media profile and we need to know who's running the social media profile. And I said, well, maybe I can do that. I go where you go when you have these kinds of questions. How do I do something? And I went to YouTube and I actually found a video from Micah, believe it or not. I watched, it was moving past just Googling it. It was that video, Micah. So I watched that video and I said, okay, I think I kind of get where we're going with this. And I tried it. And, you know, that kind of started. So it unlocked something in me where I was like, wow, this is kind of fun. It's kind of like a little puzzle. And hey, I get to do something good when I solve the puzzle, which is, having a tangible result to a puzzle solved is actually not something you always get. So that was kind of nice. And so I had that. And I just kind of started getting in it more and more. I, you know, picked up some books and started reading. And gosh, from there, it just, I found myself working in intelligence about a year later. And then, you know, here I am about 2.5 years later. And that's just my full-time job. So it's kind of crazy how these things work.
Wow, and you love to share what you learn, which I think is wonderful. But yes. You are self-taught, basically.
Yes, I definitely have had many, many hands helping along the way. I mean, I think that's one of the great things about the OSINT community is like there are so many places to learn and so many people to learn from. I mean, me volunteering with NCPTF, National Child Protection Task Force, has been a huge part of my learning. Those are some of the most fantastic investigators I could imagine, some people who are really, really experts with OSINT, you know, following projects like yours, OSINT Curious, where I get to actually learn. And I mean, I can honestly say I've learned a lot from listening to your guys' podcasts, watching YouTube videos, reading books. And so, yeah, but yeah, just kind of, I think practice is the best teacher a lot of times.
Yes. And I believe this is also why you advise people to chase rabbit trails when they find one, because you should tell us why you advise that.
Yeah. I mean, so chasing, you know, I talk about that in some of my talks, like chasing rabbit trails. I think it's important to look at things that you're interested in. I mean, and follow curiosity. Curiosity is a great leader. And, you know, sometimes you might call it like a gut instinct or, intuition, whatever that is. Sometimes those intuitions, I think, can be like, you know, subconscious things that we're picking up on, and it can actually lead us to, you know, unlocking new skills. And whether that is, I mean, for me, that was OSINT. You know, I was just curious in it. I pursued it. And it became more than a curiosity. It became a skill and something that I would build excellence in. And I think that's how all expertise really starts. And I think, you know, a lot of times the reason I encourage people to follow rabbit trails is like a lot of times we kind of discount ourselves from being, and you know, whatever you want to call it, imposter syndrome, where you like, you get into something and you're like, oh, I don't know as much as these other people, but I mean, that's always going to be true. There's always going to be somebody probably who knows more. But it doesn't mean we can't also build our own expertise. And, you know, those people who are experts got started somewhere. So.
Yeah, I agree with everything that you say, that OSINT is one of those wonderful fields where as a hobbyist, you can get in and actually start learning the skills without investing in cloud infrastructure and and high-end systems or these technical pieces of tools that many people in other cyber areas need to invest in. The lift is really easy, and you have a huge number of targets on the internet that are open to investigation privately. So, Alex, in your travels, do you find... In your OSINT travels, do you find that you ever had issues with people doing things unethically? Like maybe they post a blog post and they are revealing too much about private people. What are your thoughts about that?
For sure. You know, you've seen it a lot with a lot of major events that have come up. I mean, things like the Capitol riots is a really good example. U.S. Capitol riots. Which happened now, what is that, almost 2 years ago? Getting close. And we saw during that there was some great OSINT that happened. I mean, you can look at Bellingcat. Bellingcat did some fantastic work during Capitol riots, and I think that's a good example of how to do it well. And then you look at some different situations where various people were outed as like, oh, this is the person in that photo, but like they didn't follow any process. They didn't follow any... you know, intelligence practices. And this is why, I mean, I really recommend to a lot of people who are interested in OSINT also learning about intelligence practices, because it's really important that you have some kind of analytical process, that we don't just show up, see information. And I mean, I think a lot of why that happens, and I like to think, and I like to hope that it's, malicious, but is more ignorance based. You know, it's a lot of like, I got excited because I thought, you know, oh, this is really this big piece of information and people want to do good. But a lot of times, if you don't do it in the right way, even a good thing becomes bad. So OSINT is a great thing, but done in the wrong way, it's very harmful. And you know, the line between good OSINT, harmful OSINT can be pretty fine sometimes. I mean, I do what the majority for my day job, I do what the majority of the internet would consider doxing, you know, on a regular basis. But because I'm doing it in a way where the people that are doing it are doing very harmful things, that thing that might be normally bad is actually very good. And that's the big difference, right?
Well, I think the other big difference is that, one, you're not publishing stuff like that online openly. Mm-hmm. And the second thing is that much of what you mentioned is that you go through that analytic process. You don't just run a tool, go, aha, I found that person. Gotcha. I found some data about a person that might be my target. Let's go ahead and corroborate. Let's analyze this. So taking those extra steps, and a lot of things that we're seeing online that are termed OSINT are not really intelligence. It's more just data that people are finding. So really interesting.
Data is not intelligence. I think that's the...
And I wanted to add that you're also working towards an intelligence requirement, not just a personal goal or anything that you're posting about on the internet later. It's an intelligence requirement that serves a purpose, and that purpose is making the society a better place.
Yeah.
And it stays within those four walls of the company you're working for.
Yeah, and I think you really have to ask yourself when you're doing like these investigations, whether you're a hobbyist or whether you're a professional, you have to ask, like, do I have, what story is the data telling me? Do I have good lines and good points of verification? Am I able to say, without confidence? Because we're never going to have 100%, I don't think, at least for me, I don't think I'm ever going to have 100% confidence, because that's typically not the world that we live in. We are usually working off incomplete data, and that's okay. We all have to acknowledge that. And that's something we have to come to grips with, is there's going to be some amount of uncertainty. But can I reduce that uncertainty, and how can I reduce it? Whether that is by peer review. Peer review can be great. Having somebody check you, even as a hobbyist, finding somebody who you can bounce ideas off of and say, hey, what do you think about this? Like, does this seem to make sense for you? And I found that has been a huge part of my learning growth, has been to have somebody else say, well, did you think about this? And I'm like, oh, no, I didn't. I didn't think about that at all. And it saved me a lot of times from maybe making bad conclusions, especially early on.
I think that's one of the things, especially as you mentioned with hobbyists and crowdsourced intelligence stuff, people get this kind of fervor, right? And especially during like the January 6th threats or even the Ukraine stuff that we've been seeing, where a lot of people are compiling things together, not doing any fact checking. But I know that there was one from the January 6th where there was a gentleman who got identified as one of the people who was supposedly there, and he was a teacher, and his face just got plastered everywhere. And it was the fervor of getting it first and getting it online. There was no real OSINT, even though the person said that we did reverse image check and this is the guy definitely. And there was no other safety checks or verifications in regards to that. And it potentially could have ruined a perfectly innocent person's life who had a career and did not go to this event or whatever, but was being touted as being part of that group. And so, it's very dangerous to go through and kind of let the mob go through and have that. But it is something that I think we need to shine more of a light on in regards to verification and validation. But it's also very fun. So
And I like that you mentioned that intelligence analysis is inherently uncertain. You will never know 100% if what you have is accurate. You only know that your data is both pointing you towards a specific conclusion at this moment in time and based on the information that you have collected. And there is another thing that you mentioned in one of your presentations that I really liked, the work of taking qualitative things and turning them into quantitative work so that you can evaluate as well if a conclusion is accurate, if it is strong. And for that, you talk about certain points of verification. Do you want to talk about that?
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I think that the majority of the work that we do in OSINT is qualitative in nature. You know, we are taking a social media profile and we are, you know, assigning that like with a real world identity. we're finding, you know, what happened in an event or where somebody was. And those are not data points necessarily that you can say, okay, like it's a 5 or a 10 or, you know, it's not, there's no numbers associated with that that you can, and it makes, you know, that you can have confidence with. So it makes it more challenging, right? Because to assess confidence, we really do want to have some kind of benchmark of what's okay. You know, with if I'm going to turn in an intelligence report, I want to know as best I can that I have come to a strong a conclusion as is possible. So one of the ways that I do that, and I do talk about that in one, in a couple of my talks, I call them points of verification. So a point of verification would be something like, okay, I have two social media profiles and the usernames match, right? Okay, that's great. Now, like if it's a unique username, that might be better or worse. If their username is White House, for example, or, you know, Barack Obama, still from Micah, it might not be that meaningful, right? Because those are common. But, you know, if their username is Boston Blanc, that's a relatively unique username. But either one is actually a point of verification. They're both points of verification. But the more points of verification we have, the better, right? So if I have a username, the region that matches, the region that, you know, I expected this user to be in this region and they stated in their bio that they live in that region, okay, now I have 2 points of verification. If I, on top of that, see that they have some friends in common, hey, great, now we have a 3rd point of verification. And I kind of tend to, you know, mentally, I tend to pool my points of verification in a sort of, this is a weak, medium, or strong point. So you could have the same point of verification, right? For example, our usernames. We could have a strong point of verification in that they have a very unique username. Maybe they have, digits at the end that are very particular to them on top of, having Boson Blanc, so I could be Boson Blanc 17, and I always use that 17 everywhere I go. That's a very important thing. Usernames, as I'm sure all you know, usernames could be very personal and can be the thing that are least, are not often thought about for OPSEC. So you reusing usernames so common. So that could, but also, again, we have that same problem. But a username could be either a strong or weak point. So I really think about those a lot. And the more points of verification I have, the better. But we also have to think about, I think this is the challenging one, thinking about where does my information not match? Are there any points, I don't really have a name for this, but are there any points that are not congruent with my conclusions? That's actually more important to think about, because one discongruency could actually derail the entire thing if it's strong enough, right? If we have we believe that this is the right person, but they live in the complete wrong region of the world, that might be enough to say this just isn't them, even though, you know, I have 10 points of verification. This can't be them because I know that they live here. Or at least we need to seek an answer to that. Maybe there's some reason that we didn't understand, or maybe, you know, there's some background for that. But we want to try to understand why that discongruency exists.
Some of those things that we find in, especially like username enumeration and stuff like that, especially on like deep web forums or hacker forums, mm-hmm. and things like that, or whatever, there's a lot of usernames that are, that is their identity online. So they have, you know, if they're selling information or if they're touting a certain exploit or something else like that, there's a lot of brand reputation around that username. And we found that sometimes there are people that will do impersonation attacks, even on bad guys. I know it's crazy, right? But even with that, we call those outliers. So if we have someone like an IRC or something, and they're posing to be this person, but nothing checks out from every other data point that we know about, malicious actors and what they're selling, what sites they're selling on, what information they're gathering, you know, and then you have this off the cuff using the same username, maybe posting on like-minded forums and stuff like that. But with that stuff, it's an outlier. So yeah, we definitely go through and call those out. But they don't. If everything else is clustered in one, you've got this one little one over here.
Yeah,
you're right. It can derail or send me down a rabbit hole for days. Right. It's a lot of fun. Yeah. But yeah.
So one of the things that you were talking about earlier, Alex, about having those doing that extra analysis to make sure that your target that you think is the person of interest for that you're looking up is actually the right person, and doing that additional analysis. One of our listeners or viewers asked, what are some good places to start learning those practices? Do you have go-to spots where you go and you're like, I'm going to use an analysis of competing hypothesis, or I'm going to use some other formal process on this, or is it more something that you work out with your teams?
I think for me, it's more something that I work out with my teams. I do recommend doing some reading on biases and on cognitive processes. There is a book called Practical Intelligence Practices, I believe. Let me double check that. But I'll make sure I look that up. It's by Richard J. Huer. And that's a really fantastic book for learning some tangible intelligence practices. He gives you some really strong logical analysis and some space to actually practice that. I tend to actually work that out with a team. And I think that is really, I think teamwork is essential to OSINT for the most part, and intelligence in general, primarily because I see the world the way that I see it, right? Biases tend to be a bit ingrained. You can work on them, but they are hard to kick. And so we need people to see the world different, and I mean, I recommend you have to get people from a wide variety of backgrounds. It's just so important. And that includes race, gender, sexuality preference, like nationality. Like, you need all of those. Because if you have, you know, and I'm like, guys, I'm the heteronormative, cisgender, white male. I see the world the way that I see it. That isn't, you know, my thing isn't bad, but it is me, right? And I need people like Christina, who's from a different nationality, who's of a different gender, to come in and say, hey, Alex, have you ever thought about that? This actually, if I can tell a quick story, I'll say this came up for me in an investigation, all right? I had an investigation where the person was going by a certain slang term in Spanish. And they said, hey, did you know that this slang term is actually a nickname for the name that I was looking for? And I was like, oh, no, I didn't know that. This makes so much sense. And it was because it was one of those things, you know, like Michael, you were talking about. It was really throwing me off because I was like, this isn't the name that I was expecting, but they seem to be like their primary moniker they're going by. And they're like, as I found out, because we had a Spanish speaker on the team, that actually is the same name. It was just a nickname that I didn't know about.
Got it.
This is such a good point, and especially because today I have investigations that are limited to my area, to Germany or to a location that I know very well, rarely. Usually you cross borders, you look into targets from other countries on a regular basis in OSINT. So very good that you bring this point up. I do believe in teamwork and exactly what you say. Somebody else will definitely know something about the locals or the language or the slang, the lingo that you don't know about. And that's why I think we keep saying this in this podcast and live streams, Micah, that we need to be networked. We need to know people, somebody to ask, a team that we communicate with so that they can give us, you know, some hints when we need it.
I think one of the challenges that I've had in the past with those types of situations is you are relying on other people to be as trained, as open-minded about criticism or feedback as you are. You know, it's great that Alex is like, what do you think about this? But if somebody says, you know, Alex, you're using some type of, you know, you're jumping to conclusions here. You don't have support for this. Alex can absolutely take that in several different ways. And so getting rid of that and maybe training your whole team on, hey, let's walk through these common logical fallacies, these common biases, so that we can, without pointing fingers, without blaming, we can just call them out when we see it in other people's products so that we can have the best product as a team, can be incredibly powerful. And just cutting through all the crap of, oh my gosh, Alex doesn't think I'm smart because I used ad hominem attack on my whatever. So have you all ever come into situations where you're working with somebody and maybe they are a little bit less open to criticism of their work?
Yes. It depends on how you phrase something. I think you adjust the way you communicate criticism or feedback or anything, or the way you question something, the way you phrase it may make the whole difference in this. But I believe that it takes a bit of trial and error. You don't necessarily know how a person operates right from day one. Maybe you're going to step on some toes, make mistakes, but if you are willing to go back to this conversation to that person who felt offended by something you said and talk it out, you can amend the situation and then communicate how you are going to phrase issues in the future if they happen. I know it sounds a bit ideal, but it works. Come on.
Yeah.
And one small... Michael, do you want to add something on that?
Yeah, the only thing I would add is it's not only inside the team. Sometimes when you produce the intelligence report or you produce your findings and stuff, you will find, especially in the corporate environments, this is primarily my findings, that you will get some people who get offended by the findings, right? So they will take it personally because there are things that you have either found or discovered, or if there's, if you're looking at the exterior perimeter of a company and they say, oh, we found 3389 open, or we found this open, or we found this. And it's like, you know, they take it very personally. So you just need to make sure that you're not attacking them, but at the same time, you're saying that this is, you know, a security uplift. This is what we're doing. This is what we found. It could be fallible, but this is what we're doing. So yeah, it happens on both sides, right? So yeah, mm-hmm. It's good to know. Also, hello, Beowulf. I see someone hey, out Beowulf. There. Yay. So it's good to see Josh.
Yeah, always. Small parenthesis, the book that Alex was trying to find before, the title he was trying to find was this one, Structured Analytic Techniques. Oh, come on. So, by Randall Ferguson and Richard Huer.
Micah, I'm going to grab mine off the bookshelf over here, but I thought, you know, that would be too much time. But thank you for grabbing it. Yeah. Yeah, it's great. And there's also a PDF called The Psychology of... intelligence analysis.
Same
right
author.
Richard Tower, and he's it's offered off of the CIA.gov website over here in the United States. Hey Alex, there's some questions that are coming in, some great questions coming in from our audience. I thought maybe we could talk about some of those.
Yeah.
Let's get off of biases. I know, Alex, in the past, you've worked with younger people that are trying to get into the world of OSINT or just trying to get an education in cyber and recon and things like that. What do you think are some great places that you can point people to? Let's just cover free places that you can point people to so that they can get a start in open source intelligence techniques, tools, biases, whatever you want to do.
Yeah. I mean, we could start with the Bible, right? Of OSINT, which is Structured OSINT and Techniques by, do you know what's the name of, why, guys, book names are like a problem for me.
Yeah. You're talking about Bizzell's book?
I'm sorry?
Are you talking about Bizzell?
Yeah, I'm talking about Bizzell's book, his tome, which is quite lengthy. Christine also, I see her.
Yeah, Christine's grabbing it.
I mean, I think
what version is she grabbing now?
Yeah, exactly. That's
I think four. Every OSINT professional probably has that on their shelf. I mean, I still, open source intelligence techniques, that's it. I have the 8th edition and the 7th edition and probably the 6th edition somewhere.
Got to collect them all.
Yeah, so why not?
Yeah.
So I think that that's a, I truly do think that that's a great place to start for an aspiring OSINT investigator. When I was training students, I would buy that for every one of my teams. That is the, and the reason I like Bazell's book is he takes you from zero experience, you know, you have no knowledge of this, to hopefully operating at least an intermediate level. I think that is really, really strong. He gives you a step-by-step process. He gives you access to a lot of tools that will save you time. So that's a great place to start. I actually find that there is quite a bit of YouTube content on OSINT investigation. We are kind of very privileged in that way for our field of like, there's just a lot of free training out there. There's some paid classes. I can't actually speak to the efficacy of those, but I've heard good things about it. There's SANS courses the like. I think that those are good. I think finding a place, so you're going to take those kind of head knowledge skills, and now you need to apply them. That's the big challenge. And I think finding a place, whether that is Trace Labs for your free investigation, whether that's, okay, I'm just interested, you know, I see this big event going on and I'm going to try to practice some of these OSINT skills. I think taking whatever book learning, video learning you do and pairing that with some practical practice will make it a lot more effective, whatever that is. And that can just be for yourself. It doesn't have to be for a formalized organization. That's also going to help. So, you know, someday if you're somebody and you're like, I want this to become my career, you're going to need to start applying to jobs at some point. When you start applying to jobs, you need to say, you're going to want to be able to say, hey, I've actually, even if I've never worked in that, I did these things on my own. I had this home lab where I practiced these investigations, or I participated with, you know, this volunteer group. That was a big thing in my process. I got involved with NCPTF. Having very little investigative experience, I had more technical skills, but they said, okay, that's kind of what we need right now. And it just kind of was a marriage of, hey, you have some things that we need right now, and you can get some things that you need, you know, by volunteering with us.
I think one of the accelerants that I will say, that will make all of this go a lot faster. Yes. You can buy a book, you can watch YouTube videos, but the thing that helped me most about transitioning into OSINT or even into cyber was having that community of supportive people that are going to not necessarily challenge me, but be there to answer. One of the most lonely experiences was paging through Bazell's book and just reading it going, all right, well, it says to do that. I guess I got to do this. And then it doesn't work. And you're like, what do I do? I have no one to turn to. Yeah. So I will make a plug right now in the chats here for our OSINT Curious Discord.
Yes.
It's a free place that you can go to find thousands of people that will help you grow your career, provide you those links to challenges, resources, and other things, and just be that sounding board if you don't have people like Alex or Christina or Michael in your office.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, for me, it was that. And NCPTF was exactly that for me, was a place, a sounding board where I could not feel alone, where I could feel like, okay, like I don't know, I don't have to have all of the pieces of the pie. I just have to have my piece of the pie, right? I just have to know the things that I know, and I can add value to a larger whole. And I think that it's always a great feeling to me to know that, hey, as an investigator, I don't have to have the whole answer. I just need to, I get to be a part of a bigger thing.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. So, Ginsburg, did you have a question? Or Christina, do you have a question you want to ask Alex?
No, good. That literally was what I was going to say is community. That was one of the biggest things for me, whatever. And learning how you learn. That was another thing. Some people do really well with books. Some people do well with videos. But if you understand how you learn best, it's a little easier to digest the stuff, right? So, yeah. But
I'm also throwing in there, we had one of our viewers here, 7069WRK, mentioned the Osint Dojo process by our Osint Dojo site by Sin Windy. Another great community free resource for stepping through different processes to learn and to contribute back to the Osint community. So thank you very much for that reference. I tossed the link in the show notes. And for those of you that are listening to us on our podcast after the event, all of these links that we're putting into the show notes are putting into the chats will absolutely be found in the show notes or on our YouTube channel in the notes. So don't worry about all that stuff. So Alex, you've mentioned the NCPTF several times. Can you tell us a little bit about what the NCPTF is for those listeners that are new and what you do there?
Yeah, absolutely. So NCPTF is a full nonprofit who is structured around assisting in cases that involve human trafficking, missing persons, primarily juveniles, minors. And they assist in a couple of different ways. They actually do hands-on investigation. I think that's first and foremost. That's about 50% of what NCPTF does, is actually assist in investigations. The other 50% training and not giving knowledge on, hey, what is happening in our world. There's a lot of people who just don't really understand the full situation regarding juveniles and missing people, especially the way that and trafficking, the way that it all happens. You know, the big eye opener for me was realizing how many missing people are trafficked, especially when we're talking about kids. I think there's a gentleman I work with, and he said, you always have to ask, why did they go missing, or why did they run away? Most people don't run away for no reason. Were they groomed, lured away by a predator, or were they, you know, led by a home life to seek refuge somewhere else? So that's a part of it. And the other part is training. NCPTF has a great opportunity to get to assist law enforcement and enrich their knowledge base on modern techniques. A lot of law enforcement, especially at the local and state level, are not given a ton of resources towards this kind of thing. So they can come in as a nonprofit and give them additional resources, which can, we hope in the long term, will really strengthen both national and internationally, national for us, United States, and international law enforcement's ability to actually dig into these cases. And I mean, I don't have exact numbers with me, which is part of, answering to what I do. I should have put some numbers together, but I help build numbers surrounding the work that NCPTF does. I want you guys to know, this is a really funny thing. I failed statistics in college. just want to throw that out there.
So, look at you now.
look at me now.
So there's hope for those people that have challenges with mathematics and statistics, that later on you can join a volunteer organization and do mathematics and statistics. Yes. Excellent. Excellent.
It's funny how life works out. Your strengths,
Alex.
Yes.
that's amazing. All right, cool. So NCPTF, and the NCPTF is something that myself and several other people in the community are absolutely involved with too. Alex, within the world of OSINT, many of us are drawn towards certain things, whether it's social media exploitation, or whether it's something like IP and domain analysis or cryptocurrency investigations. Do you have an area of OSINT that you're really you enjoy doing and you maybe gravitate towards?
For sure. I for sure gravitate towards social media analysis. That is I would consider probably my greatest strength as an investigator, and partnering that with human analysis. I really, so in college, I was a human resources major. So I have always found people really fascinating, the way they think, the way they work. Part of why I find social media analysis interesting is because it is such a fascinating look into the way we're wired. And the way that we interact with technology. And I've spent a lot of time trying to understand that better, partly because, you know, I think like all of those things, maybe at some point there was an interest in myself to understand my the inner workings of myself and how, you know, why I was wired the way that I was, the way that I learned, you know, even talking about what you're talking about, Michael, like thinking about like I had a lot of trouble in school, focusing, learning, a little bit of ADD going on. So, you know, understanding like, okay, like this way that I'm wired for me was like, it's not a bad thing. You know, gives ADD actually gives me some hyper-focus at times, and that I can really use that to my benefit if I know how. So I think that that's a big thing. That's why I kind of gravitated towards those things. And it's where I still find myself falling a lot of times and where I think I add value to teams. I can a lot of times have a sort of instinctive, and from learning to knowledge of like, okay, like we might be able to look at this person and I would expect that they're going to kind of post things this way. A lot of times for me, I when I start looking at profiles, this is just a kind of a little tidbit, but I'll often say I'll be able to guess, is this the type of person I need to spend a lot of time on and actually figure something out? Or are they more guarded and this profile maybe isn't where I want to spend my time? And that's kind of that's like a human nature understanding of by the type of poster that they are they going to give you information or are they not going to give you information?
The type of poster, I really like that you brought this up. I can absolutely relate with what you are saying. And you know, this is one of my favorite areas of conversation, as it is.
Yeah, the psychology behind people is just incredible, right? And that social media, their social media posts many times gives you an interesting glimpse into what they want you to see. Some of it's very open and honest, and some of it is you look at it and you're like, you're only showing me part of what you're doing there. So it is.
Everybody's showing part of what they're doing, but why that part?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then no matter what, I think it's also important to remember that you still try to establish a baseline of their behavior. And even if they are horrible posters, there is some sort of baseline. And you are able to identify when they deviate from it and also correlate, perhaps if you have a timeline, how is their behavior around a specific event? Did something change? Could there be an interaction between these two? I also find this area extremely fascinating. I can never have enough of it. And I think there is always something to discover, something to learn about.
Definitely. Definitely. So, Alex, we've heard from several of our listeners in the live stream chats here about learning about OSINT. And one of the things that we always like to find out from our guests is, what is the next thing that you're looking to learn in OSINT? What is maybe a weakness that you want to work on or just a skill that you think is cool? What are you looking to learn?
You know, I have been spending more time trying to learn some geolocation skills. The geolocation skills, I'll admit, those are the most challenging to me. I'm really impressed when people, can tell the time by the shadows or some of those like very advanced geolocation skills. I've done some fun, some fun stuff with geolocation, but it's always been that's always one of the more challenging aspects for me. And so it's one that I actually have been spending a little bit more time investing in, just trying to make sure I'm well-rounded. That's like a thing, like, I don't know if it's the thing that will appeal to me the greatest, but I like to have that in my toolbox. I want to be, or at least know, if I really got stuck, who would I go talk to? That's always a great thing to know of, like, who's the best, maybe the best in their field in this area, or who do I know who really has those skill sets? It's one of the reasons, kind of off topic, but networking so important in OSINT, because you will never have all the answers, but hey, I know a guy who does. That's a very handy thing to have.
Yep. And for those of us that are more geographically challenged or isolated, you're in a foreign place. I mean, I have colleagues that are in Aruba or Philippines, yes, or on islands in the Pacific, and they tell me, you know, it is a little bit more challenging to go and meet people at like conferences.
Yeah.
But that's what a lot of these online communities, whether it's Trace Labs or us or Bellingcat, these Discord servers, these Slack servers are out there so that you can meet and learn from and connect with people in the community so that you can get stronger and they can get stronger too.
Yep. Yeah. Good. I would like to go back to some questions from our audience. Okay. There were a couple of questions about the tools or the research techniques you like to use, Alex. But first, I will start with Death Knight's comment. If you have a favorite or go-to tool when you do research, and where do you find yourself usually pivoting off?
So one of my favorite tools is probably Epios tool. That is a tool which allows you to take a Gmail, see what accounts are connected to it, whether that is they have a Twitter or, what have you, various accounts. And you can see if they're connected, you can see the last date that the account was updated, which can actually be very handy for knowing whether this is a account which is in any way been used recently. Very important often if you are coordinating with law enforcement to know that. Is this dead? Has it been non-active for years, or has it been used in the last month? That is important. It's not, again, like all tools, take it with a grain of salt, because I don't have ways really typically of verifying the information that Epios pulls. I generally understand the process by which it pulls, and I think it is relatively reliable, but still take it with a grain of salt as well. So, my other favorite tool, Dhash, Breach Data. Breach Data is a deep well from which I often draw. Again, same thing. There is, with the breach data, there's a lot more verification that has to happen. Because you're usually working off single points or maybe double points of verification. Maybe we have a username and an email. So we want to go and verify that stuff externally. So if I find, okay, they had a social, you know, I use breach data, dhash.com, my favorite. And dhashed, if I go on dhashed and I put in an email and I see, okay, there's a username, I need to go check that social media profile and see, is it actually congruent with what I would expect? Does it have information that matches the person that I'm looking at? But I have found things that I would have never found otherwise through breach data, because the whole point of breach data is the person did not expect this information to be out there. So oftentimes, even people with very good OPSEC through breaches, and we, you know, all of us have had this happen. I've had my data out in a breach that I was like, well, didn't really want that out there. The same is true for the bad guys. There is information out there that they didn't want to be, and we can make use of that if we are careful and we follow our practices, as we've talked about.
Yeah. Breach data can be really powerful if you're allowed to use it. Yes. I've posted the links to both of those tools, the Epios tool and Dhashed, in the chats. Awesome.
Yeah, very interesting. And I think as a last question, again, from our audience earlier today, how important do you think automation is, or how much do you rely on it versus manual research?
I am a manual guy. I'm very gritty. I know that that's to my own detriment at times. I do like automation. I mean, I use it where I can. I find the way I think about automation is I find my pain point, whether that is I have to look up Facebook IDs 50 times a day. finding a tool that would let you pull up a Facebook ID more easily without going into the source code. Hey, if that saves you 20 seconds per investigation, but you do it 50 times a day, you have saved a lot of time, right? So that's the way that I think about automation is I find a lot of, by necessity, a lot of what I do has to be a bit manual because I need the analysis is where I bring value, and analysis generally requires some manual pulling of data. However, saying that, find your places, find your spots where this piece of information is going to be true everywhere. It's going to be the same exactly every time. And I can write a small Python script or I can find a tool that already exists. Yeah. I'm not the best coder in the world, I'll be honest. So a lot of times I live off the land and find somebody who has already, I don't have to, my father used to say, don't rebuild the wheel. So I try not to rebuild the wheel when I don't have to.
Yeah. And that's the exact same thing that many of us do is, We understand how to grab somebody's Facebook ID, just to extend your example there. We understand how to do that manually, and we could do that, but there are tools that are going to make it, I mean, OSINT Combine and Chris Poulter's words, more efficient for us, right? It's going to allow us to focus on the analysis or on the pivoting or the next step in the investigation. So using tools for that, as long as you know how they work, what the data, where the data is and where it comes from, absolutely can save you time and really be an efficiency for your customer who maybe needs something faster or just allows you to go deeper. Yeah.
But like Alex said, find your space, find what you need for your investigations, what works better for your results, for your clients. And I think this is also an excellent point to wrap up with. You do not have to reinvent the wheel, find your space. And I will go back to what we said in the very beginning, chase rabbit holes because you gather experiences, you develop skill set.
Well, wait a second.
Okay, Micah.
Sorry. The chasing rabbit holes thing, isn't that just a fancy way of saying stay OSINT curious?
Yes. Thank you for ringing.
Come on, man. Come on, Alex.
You're right.
Yeah.
So we are going to close with the Stay OSINT Curious.
Absolutely.
Bye, everybody. Thank you for coming. Stay OSINT Curious.
Thank you for coming. Bye, everyone. Thanks, Alex. Thank you, Alex. Yeah.